number 973759, South Milwaukee Savings Bank versus John Barrett. And representing the corporation, representing John Barrett et al., is Mark A. Grady from the Corporation Council of Milwaukee. You will speak for 25 minutes or less as you wish and have 5 minutes to that.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. As the justice indicated, my name is Mark Grady. I'm from the Milwaukee County Corporation Council's office. I'm here today on behalf of John Barrett, the clerk of circuit court, his predecessor, the prior defendant, Gary Barzak, and although not formally, I believe informally, on behalf of all of the clerks of circuit court of the state of Wisconsin. I'm here to ask that this court give the clerks of circuit court the respect that I believe they deserve and the respect which I believe the Court of Appeals did not give them. I think it's respect that they deserve as constitutional officers and respect that they deserve under the laws of the state of Wisconsin. I think the main issue that the clerks are interested in, and the court hopefully is interested in, is how quickly a judgment must be docketed in a clerk of circuit court office. I think given a number of factors, the legislative history of this statute, the discretion which clerks of circuit court should have in how they manage and run their office, and the deference this court should pay to other clerks of circuit court, other constitutional officers, the only possibility is a flexible standard, not an immediate requirement as the bank would require, not a bright line rule, but a flexible standard that looks to the facts of each individual situation and allows the clerks of circuit court some discretion.
Why don't you tell us or tell me what you mean by a flexible standard? In other words, just looking at the facts of this case where there was a judgment brought in at 3:20, it was not docketed on that day, it was docketed the next day. Are you saying, well, it would be flexible to do it the next day, but what if it was 3 days later? Is that something that should be up to the discretion of the court?
I think
the discretion of the clerk, rather.
Justice, I think that flexibility, by its definition, means case-by-case analysis. If we have a case where we have the judgment docketed 3 days later, it may result in a different decision than this case where the judgment was docketed as the next judgment docketed, coincidentally, the next day.
Well, are you asking us to set standards then? I mean, who would, as I gather, the Court of Appeals, the argument, well, they said whatever is reasonable, but they found it was not reasonable to take a judgment on Thursday and docketed on Friday. So that wasn't reasonable. So I assume that if a judgment comes in at, say, 4 o'clock, and there are 16 judgments, would it be reasonable then to not docket that judgment until a day or two later? That you seem to be saying it depends case by case, but it would be very difficult to discern just exactly where the line would be drawn. That's what I am having a little difficulty in understanding that standard.
I understand, and the analogy I would draw, as I drew in my brief, is to a Court of Appeals decision called Granado versus Century Insurance Company. It has to do with the filing of complaints, if you will, in circuit court, in the clerk's office. And that Court of Appeals decision came down and was decided after the Court of Appeals decision in this case, so we didn't have it at the lower level. But in that decision, the question was, when is a complaint properly deposited with the clerk's office? And the complaint had been taken to the clerk's home at 9:30 at night and given to the clerk, filed the next day. The Court of Appeals in that case said, because of the clerk's duties, because of their discretion as constitutional officers, we have to give them some leeway on how we define what properly deposited means. We aren't going to limit them to properly deposited means 8 to 5. There may be circumstances where after 5 is proper. For example, the clerk is with the court on a weekend taking a judgment in a criminal case or something on a Saturday. So 8 to 5 isn't a standard we can set up as a bright line rule. They said in that case, it was 9:30 at night, it was at the clerk's home. They said, we're going to say that's too far. We're not going to say whether 7:30 is proper. We're not going to say 6:30 is proper. We're not going to say 5:15 is proper. But what we are going to say is for this case, 9:30 at the clerk's home is not proper. So that's guidance.
On what criteria?
Well, the Court of Appeals...
What criteria is the 7:30 to 9:30 at home? If you say not at home, but it has to be at the office. But, I mean, it just sounds as if it's lawless.
I don't think so. The Court of Appeals said the criteria they relied on was how far removed physically the clerk was from his normal office, how far in time he was removed from his normal office hours, the circumstances of why he took it at that late hour, if there's an explanation that can be given. Maybe his office was closed for some natural disaster for a day or something. I mean, it's hard to speculate on what the reasons might be. But because of the flexibility the clerk's office has to have and the operation of the court system, they said, we're going to look at those factors. I would say the same thing here. You look at what standards have the clerks been given to judge their behavior. Historically, there has been no problem with a flexible standard. We have not had a bright line standard enunciated by the statute or by this court for 150 years, and it has worked fine.
No, Mr. Grady, we just didn't have a case, that's all. We just didn't have somebody who was hurt. I mean, it's not usual that if you don't file it until, 9 o'clock in the morning, in this case, it's not usual that somebody's going to rush in between 3:20, right, and 5 when the office closes, and file something and beat out a lien, in effect, that is filed at 9. I mean, the chances of that happening are almost nil. So for 150 years, we haven't had the case. Well, in this case, we have it.
Well, it's true. We have a law school question here. I mean, there's not much doubt about it. It's a real-life law school question, but it's very unique facts. Mm-hmm. And
may not happen for another 150 years.
Right. And I think just because it happened once doesn't mean we have to go out and say, create this bright-line rule, impose a burden on the clerks of circuit court to increase their staffing, to divert people from other tasks that they have to do so they make sure they do this, or even worse, potentially, a clerk of circuit court in a county that's a very small county that has a number of things they have to do could say, well, I'm sorry, folks, from now on, we're only accepting judgments for docketing between 8 and noon. And if you walk in the afternoon, you have to wait till the next day because that's how I'm going to run my office.
What's wrong with it?
I'm sorry?
What's wrong with that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, except I think that it would be better if we create a flexible standard and allow the clerks the authority to run their office as they see fit, rather than creating a bright-line rule which forces them to put their office and service to the public at odds.
But, counsel, not only then do you have the potential for having 72 different rules around the state, but at least so far anyway, you have failed to articulate for this court what standard you would use to determine whether a delay of 24 hours or 36 hours or whatever was proper. What is the standard that they would be held against?
The standard is reasonableness, and it's no different than we apply in every tort case throughout the state every day. Someone looks at the facts, the circumstances, and decides, under these facts and circumstances, is this reasonable? We have some guidance, which provided the court with our brief, that came from the director of state court's office. They went out and told clerks of circuit court, specifically, I believe it was Rock County and Wood County, if I remember correctly, that we think that when you comply with this statute, you should use 24 hours, or one working day, I think more precisely, as a guideline. They didn't say that's necessarily going to get you compliance with the statute, but that's what we think would be a good guideline for you. Frankly, they're doing that in an attempt to get people from 4 days and 3 days down to one, but they're giving them a one-day guideline to try and use that. I think that's a starting point. It's not a be-all and end-all, but it's a starting point. And it's something that people like John Barrett can take and say, look, if we comply within 1 day, that should be reasonable, barring some unusual circumstances, such as, in this case, had the bank's attorney come in and not only handed the fee to the clerk that said, you know, I'm worried about this case. I need this docketed now. Can you put it at the front of the list? Can you do it? Can you drop what else you're doing and do it now? The answer may be yes, maybe no. That same judgment clerk may be have an appointment 5 minutes later to tax costs, to do something else on another case.
Why can't they have, like you do in bakeries or grocery stores, you got a number. You take your number. It goes on with that sheet. So we start out at whatever time they open, 7:45. First guy in gets number one. The second guy, and they stand in line number two. It's attached to the instrument, And if it's not appropriately docketed, whatever that means in that particular area of the law, then until 3 days later, it doesn't matter, because the deed that came in afterwards, 4:30, would still have that number, and we would know what the priority is. In law, in land law, this priority is of the essence. And it doesn't seem to me that it ought to turn on whether there's something else that should be done. The law says it's notice recorded.
I would agree, except that the statute's set up differently. The statute's set up to say that you cannot backdate an entry.
It wouldn't be backdated. It's automatically dated by number one, you know, came in the morning of that particular day. You get everything done, you start with a new number. We do it all the time.
We do have these sequentially numbered as it exists now. We do have a time of entry as it exists now. But neither of those is relevant to the lien concern. The time that's relevant is docketing. And at the time that this happened, entry and docketing were not simultaneous occurrences.
Well, why don't you say that they are in effect? That's a better argument to me. But in effect, that is a docket.
You still... One of the arguments raised by the bank is that we now have computers. In 1995, we went to a computerized system for most counties. And it's a screen, I don't know if it was a split screen or two screens. They enter the date of entry on one screen, the date of docketing on the same screen, it's simultaneous. But that doesn't necessarily solve the problem, because you could still have, in John Barrett's office on the ground floor, where they have six cashier windows, somebody coming in, paying their fee, having the clerk set the file here, and then the next day pick the file up and enter it into the computer. Entry and docketing would still be simultaneous, solving that problem, but you still have the gap from the time the person walks to the cash register and the time the clerk actually hits the computer with it.
Well, is that the discretion you want? I mean, the amicus brief argues for discretion, and I think at least that seems reasonable to me. So you use the word reasonable versus immediate, but either one, reasonable or immediate. If immediate means simultaneous right away, then I would say that the argument is well taken. Your argument that something should be done, but certainly, as Justice Babbage indicated, when you have 72 counties, it would be, I think, unreasonable to have 72 different standards and say that the standard of reasonableness is different here than in some other county, in Kenosha, Washera, Milwaukee. So I guess I'm still looking for what you would think or what you would suggest to this court if we're going to lay down some standards or some guidelines on what we would lay out in this case, because this is not only, as you know, for this case, it's going to affect all the other counties from now on. And
Mr. Grady, following through with the question of Justice Wilcox, why shouldn't we adopt a standard similar to what was in the law back in the 1800s? It's my understanding that we had two statutes that were very similar. One talked about at the proper time, as the statute seems to today, and the other one talked about as soon as practicable. What's wrong with that being the standard, as soon as practicable?
Well, I think that's exactly the standard, and it's one of the points I'd hoped to get to in this argument, was that the legislative history is, I think, beyond a doubt, beyond any reasonable doubt, says that's what the statute means. 1849 is the genesis of this statute. It said that the clerk will pay a fee or a penalty of $250 plus actual damages to anyone for neglecting to docket a judgment as soon as practicable. The legislative history, as I've set it out in my brief, has not changed that law. The wording we have is neglect to docket at the proper time. But the legislature has never disavowed the original intent of as soon as practicable.
Counsel, right? What's the difference between as soon as practicable and as soon as reasonable? There seems to be some discontent with, well, as soon as reasonable may mean 72 different formulas in 72 different states. So I don't really understand the difference between as soon as practicable and as soon as reasonable.
I'm not purporting to give you a difference. I think I see them as the same. As soon as practicable, as soon as reasonable, within a reasonable time. They're all tort negligence types of concepts. The statute talks about neglecting to docket. It's a neglect act, not an intentional act, not strict liability, but neglect in a tort kind of concept. So I see all of those things as being the same, a reasonableness standard. And I know this court isn't bound by the Court of Appeals, obviously, but the Court of Appeals, in the case I mentioned earlier, with the properly depositing a document for filing, a complaint for filing, said they saw nothing wrong with 72 different standards. The appellant in that case said there should be uniformity in the circuit court system, and the Court of Appeals said not necessarily. If the legislature intended all the procedures or processes to be uniform, it would have enacted legislation to require such uniformity. It has not done so. The clerks retain their constitutional authority as officers, constitutional officers, to have variances in the counties.
One of the things that concerns me is the treble damages. What is the legislative intent of treble damages? In the vernacular, I think the legislative intent may be interpreted to mean, and I really mean it, saying treble damages, and I really mean it, because treble damages is a rather unique event in the law. So, I mean you to be reasonable, and I really mean it. Doesn't really leave you with much, I don't think.
I understand that concern, but we also have the jurisprudence from this court that when you have treble damages in a statute, you can't broadly construe the action that leads to that treble damages. You have to narrowly construe it. You don't want treble damages to be given out easily. They should only be given under circumstances where you're sure they should be given out. And so you define the conduct that leads to treble damages very narrowly. And to do that in this case is not by saying simultaneous or immediate docketing. That's the broadest possible basis you can create liability. The narrowest basis that makes sense here, given the legislative history, is as soon as practical or reasonable. Now, I've been questioned by several of you about what does that mean? It's an amorphous standard. And I'll grant you, it's not a bright-line rule. But the legislature didn't create a bright-line rule. The courts are commonly, routinely deal with non-bright-line rules. Bright-line rules create costs for county governments, for clerks, for county boards, county executives, everything. We do, when we interpret a statute with a bright line rule, creates a cost. It means the clerk or the county board has to allocate more staff. It means they have to focus on doing this task rather than some other task. It has a cost. I think in the years that I've been a lawyer, I've come around to the view that things aren't so black and white as I did when I got out of law school. And I think grays, I used to think grays are bad things, and I still do at times. But grays are not always bad things. Grays allow for flexibility. And we need flexibility here.
Well, I agree with that. I agree that life's not black and white. There are grays, and that flexibility is important. And that flexibility is justice to treat each case as an individual rather than looking at, just say no or yes, without looking at the circumstances. But maybe this is my background of having practiced in real estate. And you check those dockets very carefully, but you paid somebody to check them so that you had the assurance of an expert. You check those dockets. And before you parted with any money in buying a home or a business property, you check the dockets, and you even check unfiled entries, etc., as best you could at every desk in the Dane County Courthouse where I practiced. Because it's a race notice statute. And if somebody beats you to the courthouse, you're assumed to have the notice of that. And if you couldn't rely on the Register of Deeds or the Clerk of Court or whatever office you're in, all the transactions were worthless. Because you'd spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, and I'm talking about real estate, but it's the same kind of thing. Spend hundreds of thousands of dollars, and all of a sudden somebody filed a mortgage, and you got nothing. You bought nothing under the law. And how can you protect people?
couple of things in response to that. One is I think our docketing system works fine. This is an aberrational case factually, as you pointed out.
All our cases are always aberrational. That's why they're in court. If everything went normally, they wouldn't be here. By definition, every case is an aberration.
But what you're looking at is a debtor who perhaps committed fraud, I don't know. That's been the allegation of the bank. Ran into court and threw these quitclaim deeds into the Register of Deeds office before the docketing occurred. And you're asking the clerk of circuit court to pay for that, rather than the bank, who could have done a number of things in this case to have prevented that from happening.
What could they have done?
Number one, they could have sued the wife when they started this collection action. We're a marital property state, and we were at the time this action was commenced. This was a marital debt, and if they had sued both Mr. and Mrs. Rooney, her mortgage, her running into court and the Register of Deeds office with those quitclaim deeds would have been of no effect.
Would you have brought them in this case, brought her in this case?
I don't, nothing illegal that she did, or improper that she did. There's been an allegation that there was something fraudulent, but on the face of the documents, she had her husband quitclaim.
Could have done discovery and brought her in, maybe. Maybe.
Perhaps, I suppose.
Right.
They were sued previously by the bank, and that issue got dropped because it ended up not mattering to the court when they were determining priority between this bank and the other bank. But
what else could they have done to protect themselves here?
They could have begun collection action quicker than they did. Mrs. Rooney didn't mortgage this property until September to, I believe, July when the mortgages were recorded. 10 months, 11 months. Had they done prompter collection activity in those 11 months to document that this was a marital debt, to stop her from doing this type of thing, it would never have happened. And it goes to my statute of limitations argument, that this cause of action, if what happened here was the fault of the late docketing, then the damage occurred at the time of the late docketing. But if the damage occurred later, at the mortgage or sometime later, then what the clerk did was of no effect. It was the bank's failure to act before that damage occurred.
Could I ask a question with respect to the activities of the clerk? Are those ministerial or are those discretionary?
Interesting question, because I thought very early on in this case about trying to raise a discretionary immunity argument under 89380, given the municipal discretionary immunity. And I don't think that's appropriate, because I think the statute creates a ministerial duty. We have to dock it at the proper time. There's no question about we have to do that. The question is how and when. And that's where the discretion comes in. I'm not claiming this is a discretionary act. We can do it any time we want, or we can do it in any fashion we want. As long as we decide in some rational manner we're going to do it in 3 days, that's good. That's not what I'm claiming. I'm claiming we have to do it. We have to do it in a reasonable manner. 3 days may be too much. It's going to depend on the facts of each case. But in this case, 91 minutes is not unreasonable. Certainly not unreasonable as a matter of law, as the Court of Appeals found. That's the difficulty with the Court of Appeals' decision, is they say, well, look at the facts of the case. Under any of the facts as they exist, this is unreasonable as a matter of law. But there's no suggestion of what could make it reasonable other than simultaneous docketing. This could have been brought into the clerk's office at 4:15, docketed at 4:45 on the same day, and I don't think, under the Court of Appeals' rationale, we would have had a different result. You still would require, under their rationale, simultaneous docketing. There's no set of facts, under their rationale, that would lead to non-liability for the clerk for anything other than simultaneous docketing. So that's, I think, why the Court of Appeals is wrong, is that you have to have some flexibility. I mean, a half-hour delay is not unreasonable as a matter of law, especially given that this statute's been around and was originally drafted as soon as practicable. The legislature has never changed that. We've got a statute that talks about neglecting to docket at the proper time, which is vague on its face and needs to be given some life. I understand that every clerk is not going to have a lot of guidance from a decision that says this is okay. 91 minutes the next morning is okay. They don't know now whether 2 days later is okay or 3 days later is okay. But it's no different than the Granado case with the Court of Appeals, where they said taking it at home at 9:30 at night is not acceptable. We're not going to tell you what is acceptable. We're going to tell you what's not. And on a case-by-case basis, through the jurisprudence of this court and the lower Court of Appeals, you eventually get guidance. This factual pattern says it's not acceptable. This factual pattern says it is acceptable. You eventually narrow it down. You don't have to create a bright line rule in one case.
Now, I'm less concerned about the liability for the moment of the clerk's office and their practices. I want to know how an individual can protect themselves. How can I, practicing law, Kenosha or Milwaukee or Dane County or wherever, protect my client when I've got all this flexibility and yet I've got a firm race notice statute? I mean, what you were doing is raising all sorts of problems about for real property, which needs firm laws, but so you're protected.
I think a couple of things are being confused. There was never any problem with the judgment against Mr. Rooney. They were fully protected from the beginning against anything Mr. Rooney had in his hands. What happened was Mrs. Rooney's ability to take that quitclaim deed, and had they protected themselves as the law and basic Hornbook law, which I've cited in my brief, the collection law says you sue both spouses for a marital debt. Had they done that, we wouldn't be here. We would not be here. That's how you protect yourself. You properly have the lawyers for the bank exercise their legal judgment in filing the collection action at the beginning. And that's one of the issues I would hope that the court would allow me to take up in the circuit court after hopefully reversing the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grady. Mr. Sostridge.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I appreciate the opportunity to present the arguments on behalf of South Milwaukee Savings Bank. My name is Mark Sostridge. Counsel is absolutely correct. This particular case and its convoluted factual history has all the complexities and horrors of that final law school exam question. We've got a little bit of civil procedure blended in with property law, blended in with statutory interpretation. But it's an absolutely critical case for those dealing with property rights and lien rights in the state of Wisconsin. This is a case in which the bank took steps to protect its interest. Its attorney did everything the attorney should have done to make certain that he obtained the judgment, had it entered, had it docketed, and went home that afternoon thinking that he had a docketed judgment. South Milwaukee Bank won the race in the race notice jurisdiction, but it lost its priority position because the clerk's office stopped docketing judgments that day at 3:20. The clerk's office has never provided an explanation of why it did that. As revealed in the discovery that took place in this case and is on the public records, the clerk's office had routinely during this time period only docketed judgments for minutes to under hour during of any given day. There clearly was no priority placed in the Milwaukee County Clerk of Court's office on docketing judgment.
And what was the difference between entering, docketing, and what should have been done? Why don't you just track it through?
In 1994, there was two systems. The second computerized system, which we now use, was being phased in. But in 1994, it was back in the good old days where everything was on a manual operation. As the attorney, would bring my order for judgment down to the clerk's office. I would pay the appropriate fee, entry fee and docketing fee to the clerk's office. The clerk would review my form of judgment, and if the clerk found that it was consistent with the judge's signed order for judgment, that clerk would then sign the judgment, would enter the judgment formally, and the clerk would then docket the judgment, which was
in
a large
document.
What do you
mean by entry? What, they just stamp it?
They stamp it.
They stamp it, file.
Stamp it, file. It has a date and a time.
And a date and time. That's entered because it's filed. All
right. That is correct. And there is a statute 80606 breaks down when a judgment is rendered, when it is filed, when it is entered, and when it is docketed. The docketing took place in 1994 when it was actually entered into the judgment docket book. This is all computerized now. There's one judgment and lien docket together. This case wouldn't happen today.
There's a docket book, and you enter in the name of the plaintiff and the defendant, and you enter in the time of entry?
Correct. And in fact, one of the exhibits in this case was the sheet from the large, oversized docket book for this time period. It reflected the stopping of docketing at 3:20. This judgment came in at 3:30. Had it been docketed, had they continued docketing that day, we wouldn't be here.
Attorney Zosker, just a question. I don't know if this is in the evidence or not, but is that true only in, quote, Milwaukee County, or is it true, would it, you say it wouldn't happen today, is that it wouldn't happen in the state of Wisconsin?
It should not happen today in any of the counties that are using the clerk of court's automated system. It is referenced, in fact, in the changes in the law itself that we are dealing with here, and one thing we must note is that we are dealing with a different statute today than what is existing then. We're dealing with a different procedure today than was followed then using the computerized system. We're dealing with a different clerk who's in charge of the office today, who obviously is trying very hard to make certain these type of things don't happen. So we have an entirely different process that is going on right now. But right now, the difference between entering a judgment and docketing that judgment is the time it takes to enter those keystrokes on the computer. Now, the Corporation Counsel's argument is that there should be great discretion given to the clerk. In effect, the example that was cited is, well, the clerk could set down that particular file after accepting the fee, maybe not get to it for a day or so. We say that is unacceptable. This is a race notice jurisdiction. This particular attorney hand-carried the file after summary judgment to the clerk's office to pay the fee and to have it docketed. Today it was raised for the first time in this case that, well, maybe the attorney should ask, is there something else I can do to kind of speed the process up here? He did what he was supposed to do. Here's my fee. Here's the judgment. Please docket it. I'm ready to go. He goes home and thinks he has it taken care of. What the Court of Appeals took a look at, and I think quite rightly so, is that using either party's argument as to what the appropriate interpretation of this statute is, using either party's argument, we contend that it should be done immediately. When you go to the clerk's office to enter a judgment, it should be docketed then. You don't have this time period or this gap.
What if it's practically impossible? You don't have sufficient personnel?
It is never practically impossible to do this. What it may be practically impossible to do for a clerk's office is to allocate the resources to do this if the clerk so deems it. By that I mean, if you have proper resources allocated to your office, there should not be a problem in entering and docketing judgments at the correct time throughout the day.
What if it comes in at 4:59 and 5 o'clock is the closing time?
The judgment would be in, and under the process we have today, it's almost instantaneous entering a judgment and docketing it. You're doing some keystrokes onto the computer, it goes onto the screen, it's dead.
But you're saying any time it's accepted by the clerk, that's it. In other words, if you're correct, timely, you get in before the office closes, then there would be no reason that it should not be docketed.
There should be no reason why there should be a delay between the entry and the docketing procedure at all. You shouldn't have that gap that we had in this particular situation. The current statute, 806.10 sub 3, recognizes and makes reference of the single judgment lien and docket. It's one particular computerized entry situation right now. I don't believe the clerk should have the discretion to avoid doing what the legislature has told them to do, to enter that judgment and to docket that judgment at the proper time. And it is key here. What the Court of Appeals did, and quite correctly here, going back to using either party's interpretation of the statute, using as soon as practicable, the Court of Appeals said. We're not going to accept that standard, but even if you look at it, in this case, it was not as soon as practical. If the defendant's wife, soon-to-be ex-wife, is sitting in the courtroom, her husband has a judgment taken against him as a guarantor of a corporate debt, has time to get in her car, drive home, find purported quitclaim deeds, which we have challenged as being fraudulent in other actions, get back in the car, drive to the courthouse, go down the hall, just down the hall from the clerk of court's office, and record those deeds, giving her a priority of interest.
But the legislature didn't say that, did they? They didn't say enter the same when filed or when left at the clerk's office.
No, they said at the proper time.
But that seems to me to have inherent within it some discretion.
It also said it should be, you cannot enter or docket the judgment at any other time than its actual entry. Actual entry in the first clause of that is when you pay and get that stamp on that. The argument that, or the suggestion that Justice Averton had, the bakery type situation, would apply in that because you would put in the date of entry, the time of entry. You're number one at 3:01 p.m. That would avoid the problem that we have here. Again, we recognize that this is a very novel situation. You're not going to have people racing out, getting these things, racing back to the courthouse and trying to get the interest in. This is also a factual situation where we were not dealing with a foreclosure to start out with. So there's no list pendants filed on this property. This was the judgment that was obtained against this woman's husband was based upon a guarantee. If you also note in the materials that are provided and in the appendix, there was a second situation dealing with docketing in this case. Now, that was raised by the plaintiffs by means of a motion to amend the pleadings. It was found during discovery where the clerk's office didn't docket a second judgment. A second judgment which would have affected what was going on in this case and would have prevented the later good faith purchaser, Wauwatosa Savings Bank, from obtaining a priority interest in South Milwaukee Savings Bank. That dealt with the bank suing Mrs. Rooney, that was the woman here, and Mr. Rooney, and certain garnishee defendants. And in that action, there was a stipulation, a determination made, and a judgment entered that the original $304,000 judgment that was on the guarantee was in the interest of the marriage, was a marital debt, and that she was responsible for that. South Milwaukee Savings Bank again paid the docketing fee, said, please docket this judgment. It was not ever docketed because the clerk's office took the position that it was a garnishment action and it didn't need to be docketed. Had that been docketed, and it was a monetary judgment because it was now saying that $304,000 judgment is personal to Mrs. Rooney, had that been docketed, Wauwatosa Savings Bank, that comes later on down the road, which she uses the properties at issue for collateral for, would not have made a loan to her, and we would not have had the conflict of the priorities between the bank, South Milwaukee Savings Bank, and Wauwatosa Savings and Loan.
Counsel, so, when does the cause of action accrue, and what's the limitation of action?
We argue that the limitation of action, the appropriate one here, is the general miscellaneous six-year statute of limitation. There is obviously a big difference of opinion between the parties is whether a two-year miscellaneous should apply or the six-year. We also, if this court determines that the six-year statute of limitation applies, as did the Court of Appeals, then it's not necessary to even discuss when it accrued because we're well within the six-year statute. If this court determines that the two-year statute of limitation, much more restrictive statute of limitation, and statute of limitations which this court has said that you should narrowly bring into being and use, simply because it is better to not destroy a party's chances to proceed on a valid claim, and there's numerous cases cited to that effect in the brief. If you go to the two-year statute of limitation, it is our argument that the bank was not harmed until August of 1996 when a determination was made that it did not have a priority of interest in the properties at issue. A Wauwatosa Bank was determined, you get it. In fact, if you look at the facts of this case, the bank already thought it had bought the properties at issue at sheriff's sale, that it issued two executions on the judgment that it had. There was a sheriff's sales on the properties. They bought and were successful bidders of the properties. And then later on they find out that the properties had been mortgaged by Mrs. Rooney, and Wauwatosa Savings Bank was claiming an interest, which led to the last case, which was a challenge by the bank as to a fraudulent conveyance by Mrs. Rooney, but more importantly, challenged the priority of interest between Wauwatosa Savings Bank and South Milwaukee Bank. The bank lost that action with regard to the priority of interest, and the remaining claim with regard to fraudulent conveyance was simply rendered moot because the only asset that Mrs. Rooney had and was acknowledged at that time was these properties. It is our argument that the six-year statute should apply in this case. It's gone through at great length in our brief. We do the analysis that this court did and would also that the Court of Appeals followed in the Erdman versus Jovico case, looking at the statute and what its intent is actually aimed at. Is the statute aimed at providing a remedy for a specific wrong or for some general public policy? And the comparison is made between two-year statute of limitations, which was set by this court to apply in antitrust cases before the legislature changed it to a six-year case in the open pantry case, as opposed to what the court found in Erdman with regard to wage claims and said that a six-year statute of limitation should apply. In this case, there is specific remedy being created for parties wronged by the errors and omissions of the clerk's office. That is who is being specifically remedied. And we believe that the analysis done by the Court of Appeals is absolutely correct, that this case is much closer and much more on fours with the Erdman case than it is with Open Pantry. This is not a situation where we have a penal statute. We don't have a companion situation as we do in antitrust, where you can have a $50,000 fine, there can be a jail term, you can have enforcement by the state through injunction. The state doesn't enforce this statute. It has no enforcement mechanism for this statute. The only enforcement mechanism is the person that is harmed. No one else would have standing to raise that issue. It would have to go through the individual that was harmed. Here, the individual that was harmed was the bank. There has been arguments advanced by counsel that the bank should have done more to protect its interests. In this particular situation, again, the bank went through the steps and actually can carry the file down to have it docketed. There is indications in the briefs that the bank somehow should have been aware of these properties and aware of the quitclaim deeds. There's no way the bank could have been aware that these quitclaim deeds existed at the time. There was no evidence indicating that they were out there. And we, again, question whether these were fraudulent conveyances and transfers between the husband and wife simply because he was an obligor under a guarantee of debts that they knew were coming due and that were going to be collected upon by the bank.
Could I ask you about, you referred to that second judgment.
Yes.
Was the docketing of that second judgment a ministerial duty or a discretionary duty?
It was a ministerial duty. It had to be docketed.
No dispute about that.
Not for me. My argument is that that judgment needed to be docketed because it established a monetary debt or monetary judgment against Mrs. Rooney. It therefore had to be docketed. The docketing fee was paid, and the docketing fee was accepted by the clerk's office. They just didn't do it. There's no indication in any of the filed materials that the clerk's office told South Milwaukee Bank, yep, we'll take your money, but we're not going to docket it. There is some handwriting from the clerk's office on that particular judgment that said, ask the administrative assistant, don't docket garnishments. But it doesn't go any farther than beyond that point. That second judgment simply reflects what was going on in the clerk's office with regard to how it prioritized what it was doing and what emphasis it put on docketing. There's extensive testimony by the designated representative of the clerk's office. They picked the person to testify. But she wasn't even aware of 806.10(3), didn't know that there was possible liability on it, that there was no training in the clerk's office at that time to let them know that it was significant to get these things docketed quickly, that there was no effort to make them do it quickly and get them docketed. So the person that was asked by the clerk's office to say, tell us about how this procedure goes that I could question, also testified that there was no procedural manual or anything that she could refer to that told her how quickly they were supposed to docket these judgments.
Let me ask this. Hypothetically, okay. Suppose the court were not to agree with you on the first docketing, but was upset about no docketing. The second judgment. Where does that leave you?
Well, the issue of the second docketing was raised by a motion to amend the pleadings in conjunction with the bank's motion to summary judgment.
Speak into the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. The motion for the issue of the second docketing wasn't found out until the lawsuit was ongoing. It was raised by a motion to amend the pleadings, which was filed at the same time as the motion for summary judgment by the bank. That issue had not been ruled on by the trial court since the trial court accepted the arguments advanced by the corporation counsel in the clerk's office and dismissed the action. So it was never entered back into the case as of yet. It was referenced in the Court of Appeals decision as reflective of what was going on in the office as to the importance of the docketing procedures being followed in that clerk's office. And the way that system actually worked is you would actually see them take the file and throw it onto a pile for later docketing. And every now and then, the docketing clerk would come by and put it into the typewriter and do it. The problem was the docketing clerk wasn't doing that.
We're obviously meeting in the year 2000. Suppose we were meeting in the year 1990 to decide the case with facts maybe 4 or 5 years earlier. Would you interpret the statute the same way?
Yes.
What I'm getting at is it's so easy to buy into your argument in an age of computers, but this statute goes back a long way, doesn't it?
The easiest way to avoid the problem today was when the clerk, the same clerk that accepted the entry of the judgment, stamps it, enters the judgment, goes over and enters it into the docket, onto the docket sheet, right then and there. Walks over to the, they used to have oversized typewriters, have the sheet of paper in there, and type it in. Now, will it be not as fast as a computer strokes? Will it be as what it takes to walk over and type it in on a typewriter? That's the, what should have been followed at this time. What we have here is the extreme case where, in fact, the designated representative of the clerk's office testified that entry could be delayed from 1 to 2 days by the Milwaukee County Clerk of Court's office, and that docketing could take up to 3 days.
When you say entry, you mean they didn't physically stamp it?
They didn't physically stamp it. They would simply take the fee and put it on a pile for later stamping. That is a real problem, but it delays it even further as far as title issues go.
How do we know it was 3:30 on a particular day then that it came in? Was it stamped some way then? Or?
Yes, the entry of the judgment indicates the time in which it was entered. There's also an affidavit that was submitted by the counsel for the bank at that time explaining what time certain things happened and he took it to the office, but it actually bears a stamp mark on it indicating the time. And the judgment docket sheet where it's typed in reflects the time in which it was entered, but then also shows the following day it was docketed. Now, one of the other issues that was raised is, well, it was the next one that we docketed anyway, so we were reasonable because we went ahead and it was the very next one. Well, that begs the question to me and actually underscores my argument, because if you would have had somebody docketing judgments at 3:30, you didn't have a pile there to do it. And it wasn't because you had so much work that you couldn't get to it. It was you just didn't have anybody to do it. It was the very next one. There shouldn't have been any delay in that. And what was also pointed to by the Court of Appeals was there was absolutely no explanation ever provided in this case as to why there was that delay.
I have a question about that. That's Appendix 16 and page 16 of the Court of Appeals. They remanded the case to the trial court to direct the trial court to enter partial summary judgment in your favor on its claim, and they say because there was no evidence presented as to why the judgment wasn't docketed, no intervening causes, then they conclude that it was not docketed as soon as practicable or within a reasonable time. So what happens when you go back?
We also have a disagreement on what happens.
And the case be remanded for further proceedings consistent with the Court of Appeals. And your opponent's brief conclusion says it's barred by the applicable statute of limitations, the clerk complied, therefore the bank's complaint should be dismissed. In all the alternative, the Court of Appeals should be reversed and the court remanded for a decision on the clerk's objections to the bank's motion and a trial if necessary. What does all that mean?
To me it means that what I'm asking you to do is to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision, which did grant partial summary judgment. It is our position that the partial summary judgment was phrased that way because there are a number of defendants listed in the action. They acknowledged the fact that we did not proceed against the county clerk, but only the clerk of courts, and judgment should be entered against the clerk of courts.
Does that end the case?
They mentioned it in the beginning of the case in a footnote that the action did not proceed against the county clerk and nothing was said that the county clerk did anything wrong. It was merely named as a party in the initial action. Now, that is not the argument that you're going to hear from Corporation Counsel. Their position is partial summary judgment means judgment as to liability and there's an issue of damages that has to be taken care of at the trial court level.
I have another question. I don't quite understand the statute. Let's see which one I don't understand first. I'll start with 3, sub 3, 806.10.3. It says, every clerk of circuit court, that's okay so far, who enters a judgment or decree, and that means stamp, file it in, right? So far, so good. And enters upon the judgment and lien docket a date or time other than that of its actual entry. Now, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the entry, or are we talking about the docketing there, when we say a date or time other than its actual entry?
There's a difference between counsel as to how you read that particular section also. Their argument is that that section refers to some fraudulent action, malfeasance in office done by the clerk where they backdate something. Our argument is it means that you're supposed to docket the judgment at the time that it was entered.
And then it says, or neglects to enter the same at the proper time. What are we entering? The judgment, or are we entering upon the judgment and lien docket there?
I believe you're entering it on the docket itself. And at the proper time is when it is presented. In other words, you can't just take it and throw it on the pile and say, I'll get to it later.
You read proper time to mean simultaneously with entry of the judgment. Well, if you read 806.10.1, it says, at the time of entry of a judgment, then it talks about money, the clerk of circuit court shall enter the judgment in the judgment and lien docket. So it's at the time of entry of the judgment, the clerk shall enter the judgment on the lien docket. That's under sub 1. It sounds to me like it's simultaneous.
I agree.
I knew you would. But
it's always easy to say yes when I...
But then how does 1 fit with 3 when you talk about proper time?
That was my argument, that proper time is that time. You can't just set it aside and say, I'll get to it later.
And that's under 806.10.1.
Correct.
Okay.
What do treble damages mean in this case?
Well, under the current version of the statute, the legislature has removed treble damages. It's no longer there. There was an argument advanced that that somehow shows that this is a statute with a punitive intent. It is not a statute with a punitive intent. Treble damages... As Justice Abramson, I think, said, this is really important, or it may have been Justice Bradley. We're stressing the importance of this docketing. We want to get the message across. And, in fact, if you look at the materials submitted in the single affidavit that was submitted at summary judgment, along the court rules or procedures of Clark County and Wood County, it says you better do it in 24 hours or otherwise you could get nailed for treble damages on this. It stresses the importance. It provides the party that was damaged. It could easily have said damages plus attorney's fees. That, in fact, gives the party the incentive to go forward and to chase, which is obviously a hard thing to do as I stand before the Supreme Court, a clerk of court's office supported by a county government establishment.
Now what, in terms of actual dollars, what are we talking about?
In this case?
Yeah.
In this case, the bank purchased the properties, at least it thought it purchased the properties at sheriff's sale, for $115,000. It was our contention that what it lost was properties worth, at that time, $115,000, and you multiply by 3, which would be $345,000, but if I could do math real well, I'd be a doctor for that. In simple conclusion, we support the Court of Appeals' decision. The Court of Appeals did not reach a determination, as suggested in the amicus brief, that they accepted our view that it had to be immediate. The Court of Appeals said that it simply, under any standard that was being offered, was not done at the proper time, that there was no explanation given for the delay. We believe that the analysis under Erdman that this Court has done should apply also here, and at a 6-year statute of limitation should apply, and that the clerk's office should be found as having breached the requirements that the legislature put upon it. The legislature put the burden in this case not upon the party docketing the judgment. The risk factor wasn't there. The risk factor was placed upon the clerk's office by the legislature and says, if there is a problem with this and you docket it late, it's your responsibility, not the party's responsibility. We believe the bank is entitled to summary judgment, and we would ask for the court to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Grady?
Thank you. I'd like to start by saying that the legislature did place a burden on the clerk of circuit court to docket judgments properly. But the legislature also made the risk-benefit analysis of what properly means. the legislature said, we're going to weigh these risks and benefits, and you have to do it as soon as practical. In 1849, they said do it as soon as practicable. In 1885, when they added this statute and left the other one in existence, that still was on the books. The revisers took that old language out, but by, as a matter of law, they can't have meant to have made a substantive change. So we'll carry that language from 1849 down to today. The legislature says, we want a flexible standard. I don't think there should be any doubt about whether this should be a flexible standard. The statute is not amenable to an immediate docketing requirement. It doesn't require that. The language doesn't require that. The legislative history doesn't require that. Deference to the clerks of the circuit court doesn't require that. And in fact, require the opposite. The only difficult question in this case isn't whether we have a flexible standard. It's how do we apply that standard to the facts of this case? Do we say, as the circuit court judge Wells said, that as a matter of law, doing it as quickly as the clerk did in this case is reasonable, it is as soon as practicable, I'm not going to fault you for the actions of a wife who ran in with some quitclaim deeds. I'm not going to fault you for the actions of the bank that failed to name the wife as a defendant. I'm not going to fault you for the actions of the bank who failed to collect it as aggressively as they could have in the ensuing months. I'm going to find that it's reasonable as a matter of law. What does this court say, as the Court of Appeals does? Somebody got in and ahead of the docketing, you got to pay for it. As a matter of law, it's unreasonable. I think those are two different things. I think it's not inconsistent for me to stand here and say, we were not negligent as a matter of law. But not to concede that if we are not negligent as a matter of law, that means we are negligent as a matter of law. Saying that we were not black doesn't mean I'm saying we are white. They're two different things. And I think that if this court doesn't feel that we were reasonable as a matter of law, then it needs to send this case back to the circuit court so that the jury or the judge or whoever can evaluate the conduct of the clerk, the conduct of the bank and its collection efforts, look at all of the circumstances there, and decide who caused this loss. Did the clerk cause this loss by failing to dock it 91 business minutes later? Or did the bank cause this loss by failing to add a defendant, a wife, or by failing to collect as soon as possible? They knew about the late docketing within 3 months of it happening. In their first execution, the bank recited the fact that this judgment was docketed a day later. On December 15th, they issued that writ of execution. They knew on December 15th, 1994, that this judgment was docketed a day late. Had they looked at the Register of Deeds office, they would have seen the quitclaim deeds. They would have known that they better get on their horse and get something done about Mrs. Rooney. They didn't act.
Does your position mean that any time someone wants to enforce treble damages, they have to have a full jury trial for a jury to determine, or court trial, for a trial so that there's a determination of reasonableness by a fact finder before they can enforce the statute?
That's a difficult question that I've been struggling with, because in the Granado case, when they were looking at when a complaint is properly deposited, the Court of Appeals decided that issue on their own without any factual determination from a jury or anything else. They said, we're going to look at the facts. We've got the statutory standard. We're going to decide whether you meet the statutory standard. They did that as a matter of law in the Court of Appeals without any underlying factual finding. Arguably, that's what this court should do. Look at the facts and say, did we meet the statutory standard? Obviously, I'm arguing that we did. We acted as a matter of law reasonably. That's what Judge Wells found. But if the court feels that we didn't, that's not the end of the matter. It gets to what happens on remand, if there is a remand. Because even if the clerk violated the statute, that doesn't mean I should be precluded from talking to a jury or a judge about what the bank's failures were and what the true cause, what was a substantial factor in causing these damages. And it's no different if you take a standard rear-end automobile accident. The defendant can say, I admit I rear-ended you, I admit I'm liable as a matter of law, but I still get a jury trial on whether you stopped too quickly in front of me and whether you have 10% contributory negligence. Or I still get a jury trial on whether my rear-ending you and causing a little dent in your bumper caused you damage. I should get, no matter what the court feels about the timeliness of docketing, a chance to stand up and meet in front of Judge Wells or his successor or a jury and talk about, okay, we docketed a day late under this law. We should be able to point out the discrepancies in the bank's collection activity and ask the jury to find that that was the cause of damage here, not the docketing, not the late docketing. And those factors are very important, I think, for us on remand, and that's why I talked about the procedural setting in the circuit court, the fact that we filed summary judgment first. The bank didn't file summary judgment until less than 2 weeks before the hearing date, giving me little opportunity to respond. I would ask that the court remand the matter.
I'd like to ask a question about that second judgment. What's your position on that second judgment?
The second judgment is not a part of this case. It is in the record, if you will, but the motion to amend the pleadings to include that second judgment has never been heard by the trial court. There is no pleading in this case that alleges any cause of action on the second judgment that has been accepted by a circuit court. They wanted to do it, but the trial court ruled in our favor, so it never had to rule on that issue. That second judgment is not properly before this court as a cause of action. It's there for the consideration of the court, perhaps it's a matter of public record, but it's not properly before the court as a cause of action. Secondly, it's our position that second judgment was not to be docketed. It was a declaratory judgment declaring the rights between the bank and Mrs. Rooney. The docket as it exists in this case is found on page 249 of the bank's appendix. It's a page which has been reduced. The original is an oversized document, has a number of columns. It doesn't have a page or a place for entering declaratory judgments and paragraphs about what the rights are between parties. This is a docket under 80610 that is a money judgment docket. It says if bank gets money judgment against defendant, it goes in the docket. That second judgment was not an order for a money judgment against anybody. It was a declaration that this debt was a marital property and that the bank, therefore, had a right to collect it from Mrs. Rooney. But if you look at the order for judgment, which I believe is in the appendix of the bank, it says just that. There's no order for judgment against Mrs. Rooney in a sum specified. Therefore, it wasn't proper for docketing. And as Judge Wells noted in the circuit court hearing, there is a handwritten note by the clerk in the clerk's office, an employee in the clerk's office, that said, I checked with the administrator. This is a judgment releasing garnished funds. There was another bank in that case who was a defendant that had a bank account for like $5,000, and they were ordered to release those funds to South Milwaukee Savings Bank. It wasn't an order for judgment against anybody in the sense of I order you to pay $10 or $100. And so those kinds of things don't get docketed. We don't docket release of garnished funds. We don't docket declaratory judgments. That's why it wasn't docketed. Now, should the bank get $5 back for paying a docketing fee that wasn't returned to them? I'll concede that, and I'll give them my $5. But they aren't entitled to anything more from the failure to docket that second judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Gray. Thank you, Attorney Grady. Thank you, Attorney Sestrich. And that concludes our hearing.